Is language, in fact, the very thing that makes us who we are? Science can happily tell us that we share a common ancestor with apes, but when it comes to language, well, there's been a lot of resistance to the notion that it's not ours alone. For linguist Christine Keneally, that is the most interesting question of study, one she's followed meticulously in her book, The First Word. Steve Paulson asked her why the study of the evolution of language was not studied for such a long time.
It was a taboo subject because in 1886, it was literally a taboo subject. The French Linguistic Society banned language evolution study, and they did this for a very good reason, that language doesn't fossilize. It's basically air, and it disappears as soon as you talk it. And, you know, there are sort of ways of looking at the body and seeing if a body might be able to produce language, but they're all very indirect. So this ban was laid down, and it sort of transmuted into this kind of embarrassment about language evolution, which lasted up until the last 20 years or so.
So for about a century or so, basically, no one studied the evolution of language.
Almost no one studied it. And the people that have studied it in the last maybe 30, 40 years have been these really smart, interesting mavericks who've kind of worked on it in isolation. And then, you know, just very recently, people like them and others have been coming together and getting a real dialogue going.
Now, this whole question is so fascinating because language poses some very basic questions. I mean, is language what makes us unique? Is it the defining trait of human beings?
Exactly.
And is language basically the same as thinking? I mean, can you think outside of language, or are they more or less one and the same thing?
Yeah, you can. You can think outside of language. And the question of human uniqueness and is language what makes us unique is incredible. And I think it's also why the subject was avoided for so long, because people feel very strongly about the uniqueness of human beings compared to all other animals. So for a long time, people thought language was just this completely discrete, monolithic thing, and you either had it or you didn't. And so humans had it, no other animal did it. And now they think of it more as this whole complicated suite of abilities and predispositions, so that many of them are old, some of them are new, and we share some of them with other animals. So as a whole, language is unique and it makes us unique. But if you start to break it down, you actually find it's this patchwork of very common traits among animals, or at least a lot of it is.
Mm-hmm. Now, for decades, there's been one person who's really dominated the whole field of linguistics, and that's Noam Chomsky. Can you give me some sense of how Chomsky's theories have laid down the groundwork for how this whole field is studied?
Yes, absolutely. Chomsky is very interested in the structure of language, in just syntax, and that's shaped linguistics for, you know, 50 years now. He made some fascinating and interesting statements way back with the publication of his first books about how language is this very complicated thing. People up to that point thought perhaps language actually wasn't necessarily that complicated. So Chomsky reminded everyone that language is actually really complicated, and that the fact that children can acquire language in the short amount of time that they do is a really amazing feat. And that sort of set the tone for linguistics for many decades. How is it that children can acquire this incredibly complicated structure, can become completely adept in grammar in, you know, a fairly short amount of time, can acquire up to 60,000 words. And Chomsky himself was not especially interested in language evolution. And you could even say he was rather pointedly disinterested. He thought that because language was this incredibly complicated thing, it was too hard perhaps to find out how it evolved, and also that it must have happened all at once. When people thought about language as this rather singular human trait, it sort of led you to imagine that first we didn't have language and then we did have language.
So his theory is that somehow our brains are wired to acquire language.
That's right. And that understanding has become a lot more sophisticated over the years. But the initial idea was that almost that there was a part of the brain that was specifically for language and language alone. And that shaped the thought of generations and generations of scholars all over the world. And now we realize that's just not true, that there is no language-specific part of the brain, that language is processed all over the brain. And there's no part of the brain that even appears to, as far as we know right now, just do language processing or language production. So that kind of needed to be broken down, and neuroscience really needed to be able to show us that that wasn't the case.
Is it fair to say that language helped human beings become so successful from an evolutionary standpoint?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we had to develop it to some certain extent in the first place, but now it's just this enormous spiral where language and culture interact with our biology, and it's inseparable from us now. And you know, if language was suddenly somehow taken away from human beings, I think there's a real question mark as to whether we would survive at all. Language is essential to our biology now.
And yet not every biologist has thought that way. I mean, Stephen Jay Gould famously said that language was just a byproduct of evolution. It really had no intrinsic value of its own.
Right. He did. And it was between Stephen Jay Gould and Noam Chomsky who felt that language probably wasn't an adaptation or a very, very useful one, that was why people ignored it for such a long time. And then, you know, various scientists came along, including Steven Pinker, who said, it just simply cannot be. Language is so complicated. There is such design in language that the hand of evolution must be at work here. And, you know, it was actually a paper that Pinker published that got everyone very excited about the possibility of looking at language as an adaptation since then.
So how did Steven Pinker change this debate about the evolution of language?
Well, in 1990, a graduate student called Paul Bloom, who is now a very well-known linguist at Yale, approached Steve Pinker and suggested that they look at language evolution together. He'd been along to a talk by someone who'd said that language hadn't evolved, just the stock line, and he was inspired to challenge that. And so they got together and they wrote this paper and they published it in this journal where a lot of people participate. So a paper is published and about, I think there were 30 commenters who wrote about it. And, you know, they really hit a nerve. Some people were extremely excited. And, you know, this can be a bit unusual in academia when people sort of feel liberated by someone's scholarly paper. And other people were quite angry about it and thought that it was ridiculous because they still felt it was, you know, the sort of Chomsky idea that the language didn't evolve. So when he published that paper, that really kicked it off. And in a sense, I think it gave people permission to look at the subject.
But yet in defense of Chomsky, it still is very hard to understand how language, which is so incredibly complex, how it could evolve incrementally over hundreds of thousands of years, maybe millions of years. I mean, how could that happen?
Yeah. Well, I think when you actually start to look at these components, these ancient components that are shared by other animals, you start to get a really good idea. So gesture, for example, gesture itself has also been sort of dismissed in linguistics for a long, long time. And people are starting to realize now it's much more closely related both to language and also to thought than we ever realized. But what we've discovered in the last 20 or so years is that apes gesture in these very meaningful ways and in ways that humans would recognize instantly. There was a very recent experiment published just a few months ago about orangutans, and the orangutans were placed in front of a table with food and the researchers were behind the table. And the orangutans couldn't reach the food. They had to gesture to the researchers to let them know that they wanted the food. So when the orangutans gestured, sometimes the researchers pretended they didn't understand what they were saying at all. And in exactly the way that a human might do it, what the orangutan then did was completely change their gesture to try to get the human to understand. If the human pretended that they kind of understood, but they weren't quite sure what the orangutan wanted, what the orangutan did was stick with the same gesture, but just do it a whole lot more emphatically. And I think people find that very familiar. And when you realize that, you know, these animals with whom we shared a common ancestor 14 million years ago, if that common ancestor had that ability to communicate and have meaning, then, you know, you're not that far a step from language. And you're certainly not going from a state of no language to language.
So what would you say are the biggest mysteries left in trying to figure this whole thing out, how language evolved?
I think what we would love to know is just to pinpoint a little bit more clearly when speech began. That's something that we're really not sure about. One of the ways that people look at that is they look at Neanderthals, who are quite closely related to human beings and the remains of Neanderthals. And the argument is that Neanderthals may have had complicated gesture, but they couldn't make speech as complicatedly as we do. Our last common ancestor with Neanderthals was around 500,000 years ago. So there's this idea that speech started to originate between now and then. And of course, we were all in Africa until about 60,000 years ago, and then the human race spread out across the world. And it seems to be the case that maybe that last mutation on the FOXP2 gene happened just before that. So it would be great to pin that down a bit more and find out if those two things really are connected.
Do you think some of these mysteries will ever be resolved?
I do. I think it's so exciting. I think the last 20 years has set this really important base level of defining where we need to look. And I think even fossils are going to be found that will speak to this problem. You know, the fossils are very rare and large fossils are very hard to come across. But I think apart from all this great work on the brain and language that we're even going to find fossils which will suggest to us when it began.
Well, this is a fascinating subject. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Christine Keneally is the author of The First Word, The Search for the Origins of Language. She talked with Steve Paulson.